Welcome to the Placebo Magic Podcast, the podcast about imaginative self-care for skeptics. I'm your host, Durmok, the wizard and peasant lord of the vast 10-acre realm of Hobdur, also known as Garrison Benson. Greetings, placebo mages. Today, what is ritual and why do rituals? But first, thank you to our newest Patreon supporter, Aeneas. And thank you to our patrons at the producer level or above, Alconet, Emily, A Sociology of Tarot, Annie, Brianne, Carrie, Dev, Fonka, Gune, Pugster, Tony, and Valerie. All right, so when you say you're going to go, you know, do a ritual, that doesn't really tell anyone what it is you're actually, like, physically doing. You know, you could be drinking tea, taking a bath, cutting up photos of your ex, you could be killing an animal, you could be taking a pleasant walk in the woods, you could be getting married, you could be getting inducted into the presidency, you could be dancing around naked under a full moon, you could be eating dinner with your family, or doing, you know, virtually anything else. So what exactly is ritual? Now, I'm not going to attempt to define ritual here from like an anthropological, sociological, or psychological standpoint. I think that's a very valuable thing to do. And I find that stuff fascinating. But I think in this case, I'm more interested in offering a definition of ritual that is useful for just, you know, ordinary people in their pursuit of well-being. So there's two different needs there. Defining ritual in order to understand cultures is different from defining ritual in order to understand self-care, right? So that's what we're going for. So with that in mind, I think the simplest way to think about ritual is that it's more like an adverb than a verb. You know, you can perform virtually any action ritualistically. The fact that it's a ritual indicates how you're doing it, not what you're doing. So what are the ingredients that make something, you know, ritualistic? It means to do something ritualistically. I kind of distilled it into, you know, four components. You know, these kind of overlap with each other a little bit, but here's the gist of it. First of all, you have structure, which is kind of like, you know, a specific order of operations or a specific arrangement of elements. Oftentimes, you know, you kind of slow things down and do things more deliberately. And so, you know, the structure kind of takes you out of the ordinary flow of everyday life and puts you into kind of the more kind of constrained formal mode of ritual. Next, we have meaning, which is that, you know, the actions you're taking have intention and purpose. And in particular, oftentimes, you know, the actions and objects and whatnot are infused with specific symbolism. So, you know, think about like the Eucharist, you know, the bread symbolizes the body of Christ and the wine symbolizes the blood of Christ. So they're not just, you know, snacking on weird little stale crackers. You're, you know, doing something that has a symbolic meaning. You know, likewise, when you're, if you're drinking a magic potion sort of in a ritual way versus just drinking some herbal tea just because it tastes good or whatever, you have some kind of a symbolic symbolism that you're manipulating when you're doing the ritual. And oftentimes the sort of slow pace of ritual allows for time to sort of contemplate that meaning and contemplate the purpose behind each action and, you know, just to kind of infuse it with that extra degree of intentionality and consciousness that you might not do in your ordinary day-to-day life. Another element of rituals is boundaries. And there's a couple different aspects of this. First of all, you oftentimes have demarcated like physical boundaries. So this could be in the case of, you know, doing a spell, it might be like a magic circle or sort of a magical area that you kind of treat as somewhat sacred, but it can also be a time, like a window of time where you sort of have a specific start and end to the ritual. And, you know, think about this in terms of religious or civic rituals. Like, you know, when I was growing up in church, there's kind of a specific moment when the service starts and ends. And within that window of time, that space, the church sanctuary, becomes, you know, this kind of ritual space. And if you want to, you know, have a conversation with your buddy, you got to take it elsewhere because there's a ritual going on, right? But once the service is over and the time, you know, you get to the ending demarcation point in the time, like the final, you know, liturgical statement or whatever, I don't know, peace be with you, or I forget what they would say at the end, but then everybody knows, okay, now we're back to sort of ordinary time and we can, you know, have small talk and stuff. And so also part of these boundaries are kind of rules. There's oftentimes kind of special rules that may be explicit or just implied, you know, so like don't talk during the movie. Seeing a movie in a theater is a sort of ritual that everybody's kind of agreed to some implicit rules, or at least, you know, hopefully they have. And, you know, you have to cross these thresholds to get into the boundaries of the movie theater. And then you have to cross these time thresholds of the, you know, when the trailer start and then when the movie starts and, you know, and then the credits roll and then when the credits end, you kind of have like the, it's like you're entering into this series of doors into the ritual and then exiting through a series of doors. And anyway, so the rules, yeah, there's different kinds of rules, like how you can handle objects or how you can dress or what kinds of speaking you're allowed to do. And, you know, to a certain extent, sometimes the rules have practical benefits of like allowing people to focus and not be distracted. And sometimes they have symbolic meaning in terms of, you know, symbolic purity or what have you. And then, you know, sometimes they're just there to be weird. And that's where we get to our fourth component of ritual, which is sacredness. And the thing about sacredness is it's not that different from just weirdness in that, in my opinion, you know, it's the point of sacredness, not to be overly clinical about it and take away the sort of sentimental and you know, take away the meaning or something. But I think the main point of things being sacred is that they're weird, that they're not ordinary, you know? So a lot of things that you see in all kinds of rituals is things that are just different for no other reason than to be different, like wearing weird clothes in a college graduation or a wedding, or speaking in the unusual cadence or style that you hear oftentimes in church, or, you know, weird grammatical constructions that you hear in church. People in ritual just do stuff weirdly. And the weirdness is the point. It's that it kind of signals to your brain that this is not ordinary life. And in the case of rituals that you repeat or that are kind of pervasive in the culture, it serves as this kind of cue for your brain to sort of enter a certain state of consciousness or to kind of attach a certain meaning, because there are things that you would never do in ordinary life. They kind of have that, the sort of symbolism or the role it plays in your associative memory is sacred. Think about Pavlovian conditioning, right? The classic experiment is like, you know, if you ring a bell and then feed your dog every time you ring your bell before you feed your dog every time, then eventually the dog's going to start salivating at the sound of the bell, right? If you just rang the bell all the time and not just when you fed the dog, then eventually, you know, the dog wouldn't make that connection, because the bell sound is not sacred with respect to the feeding. It's like if you use that sort of sacred object outside of that ritual, it becomes kind of defiled and it loses its meaning, in that you no longer salivate at the sound of the bell, because it could mean anything. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get fed. And I think that's the kind of idea about having special clothes and special objects and special locations and special phraseology that are only allowed in the context of ritual, is that it kind of keeps those mental associations pure so that you can rely on them as kind of this cue to kind of take you into a space of comfort or to take you into a space of elevated meaning or what have you, an altered state of consciousness of some kind or another. So you don't need all of these ingredients to make something a ritual. They're just kind of the common components. And ritual is not really like a binary. It's not that something is or isn't a ritual. It's more like a spectrum. It's that you can do things more or less ritualistically anywhere on this spectrum. At one extreme, you have like presidential inaugurations and weddings and high school graduations and Catholic mass and like the opening ceremony for the Olympics, things like that. And in the middle, you have things like, you know, a family Christmas dinner or a high school football game, things that have ritualistic elements, but they're still not, you know, like super, super formal necessarily. And then on the, you know, more casual end of the spectrum, there's still some things that have some ritual elements, like your morning coffee might be semi-ritualistic, or a Saturday morning nap or something like that, or like a standing date with your friends on Saturday nights or something like that. There's some ritual component, but it's still mostly kind of casual. I think of it as like casual on one end of the spectrum and ritualistic on the other end. So with those elements in mind, then you kind of know how to make activities more or less ritualistic by adding or removing some of those. So for instance, you could make the ordinary action of just like taking a shower in the evening slightly more ritualistic by just kind of while you're showering, slow down a little bit and visualize the water kind of washing off the stresses of the day. And so, you know, you've infused it with a little bit of meaning and added one of those elements of ritual. And, you know, if you wanted to add a little more, you could add some of that boundary space. And you kind of already have some natural boundaries because you're, you know, probably like locking the door of the bathroom so you can, you know, get naked in there and stuff without your uncle barging in or something. And so you already kind of have that element built in, but you can accentuate it by kind of sort of demarcating, you know, the chronology of your shower by maybe saying something when you start it and saying something when you end it to let your brain know, like, okay, now we're beginning this ritual. Okay, now we're ending this ritual. Or just assign that kind of significance to some of the actions of turning the water on or off or that kind of thing. You know, make note of the fact that, okay, now it's starting, now it's ending. You know, you could add some sacredness by either, you know, treating the space of the shower as sacred or treating the some of the objects that you interact with as sacred, and sort of when you handle them outside of that time, handle them with care and sort of treat them as, oh, this is like the revered soap, so that you can kind of have that object serve as a cue to sort of launch you into this special state of consciousness. And, you know, like you could also add this, the fourth ingredient, structure, and say, okay, rather than just kind of do all the shower stuff that, you know, and do it in a specific order. Like if you do it in the same order, you can kind of add that sort of ritualistic quality of the formality of it. So now let's kind of get into why would you want to do that? Why would you want to make it more complicated like that? So this is something I've kind of broken into a neat little mnemonic to kind of break down three main possible benefits of ritual. And not every ritual is going to offer all three of these benefits. That's probably one or two. But each of these benefits is two C words. So first we have comfort and control, then changing your cues, and then connecting with community. So comfort and control, this is kind of like a whole huge swath of a big percentage of just the rituals that humans do. It just boils down to this, which is just that ritual is like something you can control. It's kind of a space where you are in control. This space that you create with your physical boundaries or your chronological boundaries gives you some degree of power. And so like when you look historically at all of these different, you know, professions or activities, human activities that where there's a large degree of uncertainty, like where people are totally dependent on variables outside of their control, that's where you find a lot of superstitions and rituals. So for instance, like fishing, hunting, sailing, farming, medicine, athletics, life, performance, combat, you know, and in particular, some of those, or most of those, you're not only dealing with variables that are totally outside of your control, and oftentimes outside of your understanding, historically speaking, you also have to be able to perform under, you know, immense pressure and kind of stay cool and confident and, you know, be able to kind of make sensible decisions in extreme pressure or in a very split second amount of time. You know, likewise, I think a lot of us, when we were taking school tests, kind of instinctively created rituals to give ourselves more control. I know that for me, when I was taking standardized tests, I would always kind of keep my papers and my pencils like parallel to the edges of the desk, something that I never bothered to do any other time. Just only during standardized tests, I would just do that. And it just kind of helped to alleviate the anxiety because it was something that I could control right there. Next, we have, you know, changing your cues. So tweaking your associative memory using ritual. So one way to do this is through like a really intense, memorable ritual that will kind of create a moment in your episodic memory. Episodic memory is kind of like the part of your memory that explicitly remembers events. Like, okay, when I had my fifth birthday party, Joey came over and he, you know, broke my Lego set, and it made me really sad. And I remember that. Like that's something in your episodic memory, as opposed to memories of like facts that you know, or associative memories where you're like, okay, every time I see the McDonald's double arches, it makes me hungry. That, you know, that's a type of memory that's more associative memory. But episodic memory, there are certain rituals that are designed specifically to create a really strong memory. So one example would be like a wedding or a high school graduation, or, you know, it's kind of coming of age rituals along those lines are designed to be something that you never forget. And it's kind of like it makes such a strong impression on your brain to say, okay, this is a turning point, that, you know, who I am now is not who I was before this moment. And so you can use some of these rituals to create new associations and cues in your mind and kind of change your web of associative memory to rearrange it a little bit. So, you know, I've heard of people who are listeners of the podcast doing things like to sort of help with addiction, having these kind of big dramatic rituals to help signal to their brain that, no, it's time to like let this thing go, let this addiction go, using that as kind of their like launching point, the day one of their quitting process, to have this big memorable moment that's really amped up the drama and the theatricality of the ritual in order to give them this like strong sensory impression. But you can also do this kind of thing through, you know, just smaller day-to-day rituals of like every day you're visualizing yourself, you know, having a successful job interview and kind of trying to create the mental association between, you know, yourself and sort of competence in that environment. You might also associate your morning coffee with mindfulness and have this kind of associative memory where you can, you know, like change the cues so that your coffee becomes a signal to your brain to become, you know, calm and collected. So you're kind of creating clues for that Pavlovian conditioning that you can rely on later, just like rearranging the sort of semantic web of your brain in order to make it work for you rather than against you. For example, if every day you ring a bell in the morning before you meditate, then that sound of that bell eventually will probably start to make you calm, not unlike the you know, the dog salivating at his anticipated meal. And so you're practicing the association under just kind of everyday circumstances. But then when you're in strife and anxiety and stuff and you know, things are going wrong, you have that mental cue to rely on that you can go to that bell for comfort. So the third reason you might want to do ritual or make things ritualistic is for connecting with community. And this is just kind of one of the weird side effects of certain types of rituals, that it can create, you know, a stronger sense of group identity. It can create this sort of synchrony with other people, heightened feelings of togetherness and kind of increased trust and mutual support. And this could be like a small group of strangers that you just met at like a meditation retreat or something. Or it could be like an existing tribal identity that you have, like your favorite sports team or your nation or a certain subculture or, you know, the LGBTQ plus community or whatever else it is that you identify with. You know, you can perform a ritual, even just one that you perform by yourself, if you have the sort of perception that other people are performing that ritual in their own homes, especially if they're doing it kind of at the same time, that can kind of help to create that sense of belonging to something larger than yourself and having the strength of a community behind you. So in the show notes, I'm going to put a link to a recent episode of Hidden Brain, the public radio podcast that has a really interesting discussion about ritual. And they cover some of the sort of individual benefits, but also a lot of the more kind of sociological elements of ritual. Like, for instance, they cover why a despotic, you know, illegitimate regime relies on pomp and circumstance in order to kind of feign legitimacy. You know, just really interesting stuff that comes from a little bit more of a scientific, more strong scientific backing than me, you know, rambling into a microphone. So definitely check that out, because it's extremely interesting. And they talk about this kind of brain, the sort of mirroring that happens when a large group performs like synchronous actions, like singing or dancing together. So with all those kind of benefits in mind, it's like, well, you might think, well, I'm just going to make everything a ritual and get all those benefits all the time. But of course, there's some downsides as well. So I want to wrap up here by kind of going over what are the pros and cons of making something more ritualistic, of ritualizing an action. So on the pro side, we've got ritual makes a stronger impression than just doing something ordinarily. When you add this like deliberateness and intentionality and heightened consciousness and meaning, and then you maybe add these like sensory components, it makes an event a stronger impression, like that episodic memory thing. You know, also having a ritual be more structured than a kind of ordinary behavior can make those actions into a more dependable habit by kind of just formalizing this like order of operations and this procedure. It makes it so that you don't need as much willpower to carry out that action, you know, day after day. That's a huge benefit. Doing things ritualistically, you know, you can make those mental cues more sacred. In other words, more dependable as cues. So by having, you know, a sacred space that you only use when you want to go meditate, by keeping that space sacred, you can kind of rely on that space more to have that mental association, that cue, where then, okay, at some point, just entering the space will help to make you more calm even before you start meditating. And by ritualizing actions, you can make those actions and all the other, you know, all the components of the ritual more dependable cues by kind of keeping them sacred. You can also just kind of add more meaning to your life. Like we talked about in the Finding Meaning episode, a lot of it's just kind of like making it up, just deciding, okay, well, I see a school bus crossing a bridge, so that kind of could symbolize this, which is relevant to my life because of X, Y, Z. It's made up, but that's okay. You know, you're allowed to make up meaning. Somebody's got to do it if you want your life to have meaning. So this is one of the, you know, major benefits of ritual, is just being able to like look back on your life and see these moments of intense meaning. These really strong, big rituals that stand out and become one of those episodic memories, those are oftentimes the things we look back on when we're telling the story of our life and kind of trying to suss out the meaning of our lives. We think of those strong impressions and we think about this, you know, what things symbolize and what they mean and how they reflect on our values. And ritual helps you to kind of find those things. But, you know, getting into the cons of making things more ritualistic, it definitely is inconvenient. You know, it's cumbersome. It takes more time, more space, more thought, more hassle, more money, more stuff lying around. And that's just really, you know, impractical sometimes. You know, I'm kind of a minimalist. I live in a tiny house. It's like, I'm not going to set aside a room just for meditation. There's basically just one room. I'm not going to have a whole closet full of like wizard clothes, because it's just impractical. And I mean, there are people like, you know, monks and nuns and stuff who do elaborate rituals every day, but most people, it's just not practical to find the time to devote to that kind of thing. And, you know, on the contrary, the less ritualistic something is, it's just easier to incorporate it into your life. So let's say you've kind of created a ritual to help you reduce anxiety. And like we talked about with this kind of comfort and control, that's one of the primary benefits of doing rituals, is this kind of just alleviating the anxiety that comes from the unpredictability of life. But if this ritual requires a bunch of props and costuming and incense and being in a special place and whatnot, special music, that's all great, except that you won't be able to perform that ritual in the times and places where you're going to feel the most anxious. In other words, out and about, away from your home in unpredictable situations. However, you could compromise by, you know, doing your more elaborate ritual once in a while at home, or when time permits or when you want to, and then, you know, kind of have smaller, quicker, more discreet versions of that ritual that you can use out and about in the world. So let's say you have some, you know, beads that you incorporate into your really elaborate ritual that, you know, each have some significance to them, just kind of like the prayer beads used in certain religions. You could use that, but then when you're out and about in the world, you could just kind of fiddle with those beads and think about what they symbolize without having to, you know, get out the special wizard clothes and everything. And then another major con of ritual, and I think a lot of us in this sort of community suffer from this, is that the rules that we create around ritual for ourselves, even us placebo mages who we know we're just making up the rules and we're not really trying to please some kind of a, you know, supernatural entities, the rules can just become so oppressive and stressful and a source of anxiety in their own right. It's so amazing how quickly we go from trying to come up with a system for self-care to living under the oppression of our own, like this regime we've created in our mind of all the things that we're supposed to be doing and doing in a just so certain way. These practices are intended to be for our health and well-being and happiness. So if they're making us miserable, then they're not functioning. You know, we got to ease up. And so if you're trying to use, you know, a ritual like, say, a daily meditation to improve your life, that's great. But if you find yourself having a bunch of anxiety and guilt and shame about the fact that you're not meditating, or you're not meditating at the right time of day, or you're not doing it in the right way or something, or you can't like get all the ingredients in place of wearing your special meditation clothes and your special music and everything, like just change the ritual to make it more casual, make it less ritualistic, relax the rules, relax the formality, relax the schedule, just make it more relaxed. Like, you know, going to a really formal family dinner might be nice once in a while, but if you had to do that every night, it would be kind of a bummer, you know. And similar with rituals, it's nice to do really elaborate things and intense things and formalized things every so often. But if they become a source of anxiety rather than becoming a source of comfort and control, that's when you need to stop and ask, am I making this too ritualistic? So I like to picture it like it's a lever, like a throttle. and you can kind of shift up to a more ritualistic kind of thing, or shift down, and you can kind of, you know, take the same basic activity like eating a meal or meditating or taking a walk, and you can upshift into more ritualistic or downshift into less ritualistic or anywhere in between. And you can kind of just adapt your routines based on that. And so rather than, you know, we're going into the new year here. So rather than say, oh, I'm going to abide by all of these rules during the new year and that's going to keep me in line, try to, you know, maybe be more, a little more adaptive and say, well, I have these structures that could help me to feel better and feel less anxious and be more in control. But if they're not doing that, if they're becoming a source of anxiety, I'm going to downshift a little bit and just kind of keep adapting and observing and seeing how are these things actually making me feel, rather than just kind of making a rule that then you can judge yourself against. You can find the Placebo Magic Podcast and my poetry on the web at garrisonbenson.com. Leave a voicemail for the show by calling 989-318-4118. Music is by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com and licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license. You can support the show by giving us a review on your podcast app of choice, sharing an episode with a friend, or becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/placebomagic. Patreon supporters also gain access to our Patreon-exclusive bonus show. Remember, magic is a metaphor, and metaphor is magical.